Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest tonight is Jay Dyer. He returns. How are you doing, Jay?
Doing great. How are you?
Excellent, Jay. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Sure.
And, of course, tonight, well, we want to focus mainly on your book, Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. Of course, you are the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, and that's jaysanalysis.com. Go to his website, and if you enjoy his work, you can always sign up for a membership for a mere pittance, less than $5 a month, from what I understand. So, okay, well, last time we spoke, we talked about you had coming close to concluding your lecture series on tragedy and hope. And I think you already summarized that. And on tragedy and hope, what's the big takeaway from Carol Quigley's tome, his magnum opus?
The big takeaway is, if I were to summarize it briefly, that democracy in the Western sense is the greatest hope for the world. And despite the wars and tragedies that we've had, we can still save the world with this fuzzy sort of ideology that in Quigley's mind in some way is born out of the Western Catholic tradition, which I don't actually buy that argument, but in his mind, it's some sort of loosely influenced notion of human rights and, as I said, some form of democracy or populism, and that these fuzzy notions can still be projected onto the rest of the world. But we don't ever, because Quigley is a military historian and not really a theologian, although he does actually in the end of the book hit on a couple of theological insights that sort of line up with things that Dr. Joseph Ferrellis talked about in his theology books, God, History, and Dialectic. There's, as a whole, the book is an instruction manual, a kind of apologetic to tell members of the establishment that what we're doing is ultimately for the good. And yeah, there's going to be bumps along the road, but we can still revive this corpse of Western democracy, is I guess the only way I could think of summarizing the book. That's how that's how it ends, more or less. So tragedies occur, but the hope comes out of the Western idea. And of course, and I disagree with, I don't think that democracy is the Western idea. I mean, people will say, oh, you know, we go back to Greece or something. I don't think that Greece is necessarily like the high point of civilization. But, you know, in Quigley's mind, that Atlanticism can play a salvific role. And he even admits the dangers of the coming technocratic managerial society. He says it's more or less inevitable, but he sees it as also dangerous to, quote, democracy and all that. So that's what the book's about.
And, of course, the revelation, which most people are familiar with, is he talks about this elite circle or group of people primarily operating out of London, but also Washington now.
In New York, yeah.
In New York, and this is the bankocracy, the banksters,
yeah.
The financial
yeah.
elite.
The New England Atlanticist axis that establishment Cliveden set tied into the elite of London, and he doesn't say much about the Vatican. Interestingly, he does mainly talk about the geopolitical motives of London and New York and Washington, but and Wall Street. But yeah, that is that private clique that is behind, that is a kind of dynasty still. I think you could argue that he makes it a little more realistic in the sense of different banking empires and houses and dynasties, but it's more or less the same banking power that has been in charge even back to the time of the Enlightenment and French Revolution. So the revolutionary period that we've been undergoing in Western civilization from that time, according to Quigley, roughly, is a monetarist banker revolution. And so those bankers are still more or less in charge. And the changes in society can ultimately be traced to their influence through their many legates and outlets, including foundations and NGOs. And, it's really in the period that Quigley's writing that the NGO is starting to come into existence. I think he, in the Latin America chapter towards the end, he discusses under JFK, the Alliance for Progress, and this was kind of an NGO set up under JFK in tandem with the CIA to kind of influence all the economic and governmental policy in Latin America. And now it apparently wasn't that successful, according to Quigley, but that is kind of the model, right, of how things are happening even now that we see in Syria or Ukraine, and we think of, Soros's group, National Endowment for Democracy, and then this kind of on the RAND model, the think tank model, right? So this is what, these are all kind of it's like I was telling somebody, I forget who told me this, but we're talking about the CIA and Wall Street, and we were saying, I think it was Henrik, how do you understand the CIA? The CIA are basically worker bees for Wall Street and the banking elites, right? So they're not James Bond.
Yeah, that's what Fletcher Prouty more or less concluded.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
the secret team. So that's what Quigley's book's about, is about explaining the 20th century in its real story to people who are going into the establishment.
And what now we look at again, it's the with Tragedy and Hope we look at it as a sort of a revelation. But it was written as sort of an in-house guidebook or,
right.
For elites, people who are in the State Department, CIA, maybe DOD, maybe Wall Street.
Wall Street, right.
Yeah. And so, but it was also a justification. Instead of he's revealing this stuff, it's an apologetic for the ruling elite. You had a recent interview with F. William Engdahl, and you were discussing the book. And he had it on his shelf. Apparently, he had read it too. So there's two people actually talking together. Actually, read Tragedy. No, that's probably the first time in history that's happened. They read the actual book from cover to back, but front to back. But he made an interesting point regarding. Apparently, he said that Quigley was given conditional access to the CFR archives, that he would not emphasize or mention the name Rockefeller.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to spark a debate. Rockefellers are mentioned more than once.
Okay.
But they did. Professor Engdahl's correct that they are not emphasized in the book at all.
Yeah.
Which is curious, because if you read David Rockefeller's memoirs, or if you read Collier and Horowitz's authorized biography of the Rockefellers, they obviously play a huge role.
Yes.
So, yeah, just that's just. And I've noticed this a lot of times when you read these kind of big puzzle piece books, even in those, you're still only getting partial picture. Now, uh-huh. obviously, that's all of us being human. You know, we're limited and finite, so we're always going to have a partial picture to some degree. But even in these giant tomes and revelations and exposés, you know, there can often be big pieces of the picture missing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you read on the JFK, or not JFK, excuse me, the Diana situation, Princess Diana, I've looked at several different books, and then if you look at Gordon Thomas's book on the Mossad, there's some very interesting details that pop up in his book in the first chapter that I haven't found elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So you see what I'm saying? Like, there's kind of you'll find puzzle pieces in different books. So if you were to read Tragedy and Hope and, say, David's memoirs, the two would complement each other very well, as would Psychological Warfare and the New World Order.
Yeah.
Because he spends the first 100 or 200 pages talking about the CFR.
And also the whole idea of dialectics and controlled opposition, which I think what you're alluding to there. That's Servando Gonzalez's book regarding Castro, who just passed away. And he makes a very good case because he analyzes Castro, I think, as an intelligence analyst, not as an historian. And an intelligence analyst, you don't take things at face value. Historians often take things at face value.
Yes, and exactly.
Yeah, so
that's I love that point that he made at the beginning there, and having done an undergrad in history, I understand that point because we, you know, in my history classes, we never covered that. We never talked about different approaches to how you read history, and it was almost always. Like we might do a historiography or something like that, where you know come up with a whole bunch of different sources on a certain topic, and then you kind of try to separate wheat from chaff and figure out what the closest thing to the truth might have been in some event or person's past or something. But you never talk about the possibility of disinformation. Now if governments engage in disinformation, which they do and they have for millennia, then you would think that would be an important aspect to the approach that the historian takes. And so I think Servando is totally correct.
Or when you study political science, there's no course on, say, underground criminal cartels.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah.
Or secret societies in general.
Yes.
The notion of a synarchy, of a shadow government.
Yeah, in my French Revolution class, there was only now, to be fair, Ed Palmer, R.R. Palmer, who's a famous French Revolution historian, he at least does admit in one paragraph of his book on the French Revolution and Napoleon that, yes, there was a kind of Masonic Illuminist role in the French Revolution. So, but the rest of the books, and we had quite a few in that class, you know, it wasn't really mentioned. The professor mentioned it kind of in passing. Now, I would think that would be pretty important if the philosophy that's enacted at the French Revolution is based on the philosophy of the secret society behind it.
Yeah, because there's a Black Hand, as there's an organization called the Black Hand, which precipitated a very, very major event in Western history,
World War I, right?
Yeah. So, and that concept where it gets brushed aside as conspiracy theory, wacko stuff, and all, unless they want to, you know, promote a Cold War, then they'll say, you know, right. there's a communist under every pillow, and you know, and that conspiracy is acceptable. There's acceptable conspiracy. The idea that, you know, because de-emphasizing the Rockefellers, because historically I understood it was the early part of the 20th century. You could divide American politics into two camps. That was the House of Morgan and Rockefeller. And by the 1930s, the Rockefeller House had eclipsed the Morgan and kind of absorbed it, and the elite became more unified in the 30s and 40s, which what you see. So that's an interesting point.
Well, they dominate all these things. They dominate the CIA. They dominate CFR. I think Gonzalez points out that even prior to the CIA, the OSS, you have the Inquiry, which is these academics. The Rockefellers dominate medicine. They dominate academics. They dominate seminaries. especially Protestant seminaries mm-hmm. that they buy off. So there, yeah, absolutely.
And I think they even started the American Historical Association, or at least funded it.
Oh wow, I didn't even know that.
I think they got a role in the American Psych. You know, the same as and sociology comes out of University of Chicago, which is a Rockefeller operation.
Yeah. So yeah, that I did know there. The whole that's a whole created discipline straight from.
And it's off of social engineering.
You know? Absolutely.
So, but anyway, I want to give you some kudos for that whole series. It was quite an accomplishment, and I enjoyed it immensely. I enjoyed talking to you about it. I want to thank you for coming on so many times to talk about it.
Well, I'm honored that you allowed me to come on and talk about it so many times. Nobody else did. Nobody else.
Oh, it's fascinating how people pass that up. No one. I said I interviewed Bill Plummer, or not Bill Plummer.
Joe.
Bill Plummer was a catcher in the 70s for the Cincinnati Reds. Joe Plummer. Joe Plummer, and his book is very good because it's an intro thing. It's like sort of like an outline.
Mm-hmm.
He gives it a certain look, but your analysis goes in much deeper. It's a completely different approach, I think, for anyone to add something different to this is quite an accomplishment. It's value added research.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I intend to kind of continue with that model and maybe do some more of these big tomes, some Brzezinski or something like that next, or maybe Grand Chessboard or something like that.
And if it sparks interest and tempts other scholars or intellectuals to look at the book and even offer competing theories, we're all enriched by it. And that's the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not to point fingers at each other saying you're a shill, you're wrong. No, read it yourself and offer up maneuver, because there might be some more insights into this tome.
Mm-hmm.
That's the value of this stuff. So it was great work. Now, you have your book recently came out, Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. And you sent me the PDF, so it gave me a chance to read through it, and I'd say it was a very enjoyable read.
Excellent. Okay, good.
Well written, and the way it's constructed is excellent because you have these sidebars, they explain things, and mm-hmm. For the typical reader who might just be curious about this stuff, it's very, for someone who's more familiar with it, it's very helpful too, because it mm-hmm. refreshes stuff and expels things out, names, philosophers, and ideas, and how these ideas have been applied. In right. Hollywood and entertainment and culture in general, but it's also very good for someone who isn't familiar with it, So it's from both the layperson and someone a notch above the layperson in this topic. Mm-hmm. It's very useful. So it was hard to put down. So,
well, that's what I was going for. I really wanted to be able to speak to, like you said, not just the man on the street, but also, persons who were familiar with the topics and try to expand kind of what was already out there. But there's also, I noted, a lot of people might have read one of my analyses, but they hadn't read, the 20 or 30 other ones that are in the book. So there's, I think people will be interested in like the first 90 or so pages on Kubrick, and then you got another 70 or 80 on Spielberg movies, and then you got kind of a satirical, goofy section on 80s movies, and Hitchcock. So I think it'll have a broad appeal with just the popularity of those directors. But I also chose analyses that I thought were that had an important message, and I think that I really wanted to make an argument against scientism. that was a big part of why I included that H.G. Wells section in the book.
Because Hollywood plays a big role in promoting it.
It does. And we tend to think of things, there's all the occult, and Hollywood promotes Satanism and the occult and transgender. And yeah, it does. And I do touch on those topics, especially the esoteric stuff. But we can't forget that the Darwinian mythology, which is a big part of the establishment,
yes,
social engineering has been promoted by Hollywood,
and that's and, say that. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say most of these science fiction stories are really kind of grounded in that mythos.
Mm-hmm. From the dust jacket, it reads, or from the back of the book rather, because it's soft cover. Like no other book before it, this work delves into The deep, dark, mysterious undertones hidden in Tinseltown's biggest films. Esoteric Hollywood is a game changer in an arena of tabloid-populated titles. After years of scholarly research, Jay Dyer has compiled his most read essays, combining philosophy, comparative religion, symbolism, and geopolitics, and their connections to film. Readers will watch movies with new eyes, able to decipher on their own as the secret meanings of cinema are unveiled. So there you go. That's a great summation. So,
thanks. Yeah, that was actually more difficult to write than you would think. I forget what that was for. I think that was for the initial proposal. That's what I wrote, and I was thinking, well, how would you summarize like what, say, 30 of these, 20 or 30 of these film analyses? What are they? I mean, they're kind of all over the place, but but it worked out.
But you start out well. The first chapter is I like you had an interview with Hendrick, and he's talking about Hollywood, and he described what is Hollywood, and he says, I think he described it, I'm going to paraphrase it, something like, as a virus placed in the mental software of humanity.
Yeah.
And that, a virus, that is a good way to put it. Now, you start out, the first chapter is the occult empire, and film is a ritual. Mm-hmm. And this handles Kubrick, Eyes Wide Shut, and, the occult empire and film is a ritual. You want to explain that?
Well, one of the things, if you're into theology, is that you, or especially the more classical theologies of Orthodoxy or Catholicism, then you understand life as ritual because you have a church calendar. And the church calendar is the kind of what we were in Christendom supposed to live by. And then, of course, the secular calendar was put in place for the time of the French Revolution is where they first tried this. And then subsequent versions of this with where you're given civic saints and you're given Martin Luther King Day and you're given all this kind of stuff to be a replacement of the older notion of the church calendar, which shows, by the way, man's fundamental religious nature, by the way. Why are you having to create a civic religion if man is not fundamentally religious?
And you make that very important part of the book, yeah.
So film as ritual is another aspect of this this phenomena of man's being, where he reflects his religious being, his religious aspects of his being, not just in his church, but also in his art or in his worship. So his artwork is also part of his religious philosophy, his worldview, and it's going to necessarily reflect what man believes, whether he acknowledges it or is cognizant of it or not. And you know, the same could be said of architecture, right? We think about architecture reflecting the norms and values of a society, and that's why you get all this hideous Bauhaus and modernist abstract art nowadays. Whereas if you look back to something, say, in the Baroque period, obviously much more beautiful, and you know, it reflects hierarchy and things like that. That was more normative for those societies in terms of their presuppositions. But so film as ritual is one angle of man's artwork. And it's particularly powerful because it, as we've talked about in the past, I think the first time you had me on, we talked about Plato and the cave and how, the ability of storytelling through film to combine, you know, sound and sight and music and editing and manipulation of time and all that becomes a very powerful means that led to the usage of film and propaganda, or excuse me, film as a means of propaganda on the part of the establishment. So, but what I do is I keep it in the context of religious philosophy and comparative religion in this first section. And I talk about Mircea Eliade, who's a famous comparative religion scholar, and he's written some really good books. Sacred and the Profane is a really good book. And he discusses the notion of threshold and of the sacred space and things like that for mankind, you know, throughout time. And we could look at Hollywood as a version of that, where you have this, if we set aside Christian thought for a moment and we think about just life in America, well, a lot of people grow up thinking that Hollywood is this sort of grandiose, make your dreams come true type place where, like, if you've seen L.A. Confidential, that movie, there's a beginning of the film where there's a monologue that Danny DeVito reads where he talks about Hollywood, you know, the greatest place on earth. All your dreams will come true. And the point of the movie there at the beginning of L.A. Confidential is actually to promote tourism and to promote people moving to L.A. and Hollywood, to build it up, for economic reasons and so forth. And that was back in the 30s or 40s was when the movie takes place. A really good movie, by the way, with Russell Crowe and Aaron Eckhart. But so film as ritual is the notion of Hollywood as a kind of empire. And it has become a kind of empire. It's a magical wonderland of creating the synthetic, right? Of becoming the new Olympus, of the source from which people nowadays tend to derive the meaning of their lives. And because humans don't derive meaning from, you know, bare scientism and facts, right? We don't read Newton's Principia and say, now we've discovered the meaning of life. Because it doesn't give meaning, it just gives explications of how, right? Like cause and effect, right? Well, cause and effect doesn't give you a meaning. Because meaning, I believe, assumes or points to the eternal. And you'll never get something eternal from only the temporal or only material, right? It has to always point beyond it, I believe. And Hollywood and film, I don't think it was initially going to be that. When Edison created the camera, or was involved in developing the camera, and there was the sort of early experiments done where they chopped off people's heads and people thought it was real on the film reels, and the famous instance of the train coming at the crowd and the people thought the train was real. I think they started noticing, in the beginning of the invention of it, that it could be used for this. And so what you had was a form of art that could have been, and probably was for a while, positive in its effects, but very quickly began to be utilized for something dark. And as Henrik said in the interview, whether you believe in real demons and black magic and voodoo or not, the effect of Hollywood can be the same. And so what Hollywood does is kind of put everybody under this voodoo spell, this magic spell of believing the mythology and believing the lies about it. You know, think, for example, of the idea that, you know, if you're good and talented in the arts, and if you go out to L.A. or something, or, you know, this older mythology, you'll be successful if you're good and talented, when the reality is that the way that people climb the top of that ladder often puts them into pornography. You know, they often end up addicted to drugs, prostitution, right? It's more like a mafia or a cartel.
Yeah, that's Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I believe that's the point of that film.
Yeah.
And so that's why I talk about it as a ritual, is that it's a kind of dark ritual, and I think the establishment understood from the perspective of social engineering that they would have to. Well, think about full spectrum dominance. F. William Engdahl's book. Full spectrum dominance isn't just a geopolitical motive of, you know, containing Russia or something. It also includes the arts. And this is what we've seen for so long with, you know, the Frankfurt School, and we've talked about in our circles many times in interviews, is this influence of these, the Rockefeller Foundation and the OSS working with the Frankfurt School to engineer art, you know, and recruiting people like Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol to produce this weird, bizarre, and ultimately degrading art down the road that would have a direct effect on mankind and how he viewed himself and viewed the world. And that's actually what, you know, some of the Frankfurt School people say. That they say that bestiality and necrophilia could be, you know, if this becomes quote art, right, then this can have a powerful effect on society. And there's a lot of different takes on this and articles, and some people call it aesthetic terrorism, where you kind of induce trauma through the arts. So all of that is kind of what I'm dealing with in the book. And I talk about Foucault, And the reason Foucault's postmodernism is relevant is because he said that basically this Enlightenment idea that we would move away from superstition and priestcraft and that we would get instead this kind of learned society where everybody was a citizen journalist and, you know, looking at the facts and, you know, all this nonsense that didn't ever transpire. Foucault pointed out that we still live in a priestly society, right, with hierophants and shepherds, as he called it in one of his famous essays. And the shepherds, he talks about, in that essay, I think he talks about them being the scientific class, right, the quote scientists. But the same could be said for the myth makers, and that's what we would get with Hollywood. Hello.
Sorry. Go ahead. I hit my.
No, that's all. I was just going to close there with the point about Foucault and what his point was.
Yeah. And that's the myth makers, the cultural mandarins, the people who can tell a good story or have, you know, technology at their disposal, particularly special effects. And that's what the big thing of the cinema is, because the
psychological Wizard of Oz,
the psychological warfare, the great potential of this of that became, you know, of course, with the motion picture, and that fundamentally changed things like pornography,
right? Well, in chapter one, after that introduction, everybody I think has probably heard of the book if they haven't looked at it. It's kind of a boring book because it's, you know, it's all about these like 20s and 30s era people that nobody remembers anymore. Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon, and of course he was, you know, a Satanist and a Luciferian and in the circles of Crowleyanism and so forth. And what Anger did was kind of present Hollywood as a resurrection of the ancient pagan empire of Babylon. And that is appropriate, especially if you've been to LA or Hollywood and, you know, you've seen the big Babylonian gate from the movie that it's now a shopping mall. I was just there a few months ago.
Oh, that, like the silent movie?
Yes. Yeah.
Is it Temptation or something? Or
something like that. Yeah. So it's very ironic, right? I mean, and there's all kinds of, I mean, you could do a whole book just on the architecture and Masonic and occultic symbology of Hollywood. We went to the Griffith Observatory and it's all completely Masonic. The reason I was talking about that was that what I wanted to do with the book was kind of be a sort of like Hollywood Babylon, but kind of a corrective to it, like a different take on the point that Kenneth Anger is making in his book.
Yeah, it was Joseph Breen who led the production code for the first 20 years of his existence, and he had this quote. He said there about Hollywood. They are a simple, rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond making money. Here in Hollywood, we have paganism rampant in its most virulent form. Drunkenness and debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and our stars are perverts. Then he focuses on, of course, the one ethnic group that dominates Hollywood, the Jews. He said the Jews seem to think of nothing about money making and sexual indulgence. The vilest kind of sin is a common indulgence hereabouts. And the men and women who engage in this sort of business are the men and women who decide what the film fare of the nation is to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the importance of the production code. It kept Hollywood on a short leash for a while.
Now, what's interesting, you mentioned that code. At the beginning of Hollywood Babylon, that's what an admittedly wicked guy himself says about Hollywood.
Yeah.
He himself says, yes, it's absolutely 100% a perverse, degenerate racket, really. And, you know, that's why you've seen ties into the mob. That's why you've seen all manner of perversion. That's why it's now, the champion of pushing the whole gay and transgender agenda.
And it's almost like I've always thought, if you look at Hollywood and how it the seedier side, the underbelly of what really goes on. And same thing with Las Vegas. You get a glimpse of how America really operates.
Exactly. There you go. That's Vegas is a great – it's kind of the theme park addendum appendix to Hollywood.
Now, I just want to mention this. I was just watching some clips on YouTube from the movie Casino.
Yes.
You know, of course, there's fictional characters are based on very real people.
Right.
And I didn't catch this. I know you've been reading Program to Kill.
Yes.
And you know Dave McGowan's thesis regarding at least one aspect of the serial killer phenomenon.
Right.
Another version of Murder Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't catch this at first when I saw – I've seen the movie a couple of times. But you remember the scene where Pollock plays the clean face, the kind of the puppet who owns the casino? And he's kind of like the president of the United States, you know, getting off the plane, ask questions. And there is – he has this lady, middle-aged lady who was like a silent investor that no one knew – the mob didn't know about.
Uh-huh.
And she's starting to ask questions about the books. And he can't brush her off anymore. So she takes him to court and sues him and wins. And they have to open up all the books. And it goes through this narration of how it's handled with the mob, the boys back in Kansas City. And the kid says, "Oh, this isn't good, man." They open the books and find out where the funding came from, you know, the Teamsters and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the mob says, so the narrator goes, "So they just, the bosses decided to settle the case out of court."
Oh, right.
So the scene where she's reading, drinking her coffee in the morning in her kitchen, and on then comes in this hitman and takes her out with six bullets in the head. And next scene is Pollock, who, Mr. Green, I think is his name, I think, in the movie, comes out and they start questions about his investor who just died. He doesn't know anything about it. He's obviously shocked by the news. Then he starts saying, "Well, we just did some business deals together. We weren't really partners, blah, blah, blah." But at the last second, the reporter goes, "Does this have anything to do with the .22 caliber killer? You know, like a serial killer."
Oh, wow.
You know, it's like, wait a second, that's out of that thing, you know, they're blaming it on a serial killer.
Wow, yeah, I saw Casino, you know, when it came out back in the 90s or whatever, so I'd totally forgotten all that.
Wow, that's interesting. It just, at the last minute, does this have anything to do with the .22 caliber killer, mm-hmm. you know, like the Bind, Torture, and Kill killer,
Yes, BTK.
Jeffrey Dahmer, whatever. But go ahead, I thought that was interesting. But how, basically, we get a glimpse of what's really going on through Las Vegas, through Hollywood, and how it is sort of a microcosm for how the world is really run in many respects.
Yeah, and until you understand the whole black market aspect of the economy with drugs and human trafficking and all that and the prostitution, you really don't get the quote New World Order.
Yeah, and I was just rereading Catherine Austin Fitz's Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits.
Uh-huh.
And about how it was laundered drug money which financed the RJR Nabisco merger in the 80s.
Oh wow.
Yeah. and there's a European Community lawsuit. At least there's an accusation to that effect, how send carts and carts of cigarettes over to Europe, and the drug dealers would buy the cigarettes, and the cash would go in their RJR Nabisco's coffers.
Yeah, well, and that's essentially what I get into, not that specific case, but that model in the Spectre section of the book,
mm-hmm.
then the Quantum of Solace section.
Yes, and that's not. Yeah, now this is Hollywood. Now you examined Kubrick, particularly a couple of his movies, Eyes Wide Shut and 2001: Space Odyssey,
and
The Shining. I'm sorry. Yeah. Now in Eyes Wide Shut, you proffer the idea that it is both a revelation and an initiation of the public. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I have seen Kubrick make kind of off the cuff esoteric references. He does talk about magic and fairy tales and telling magical stories. Now, he says that those are more real than quote reality. So that to me suggests, Kubrick may have had some idea of, Kabbalistic teaching or something like that, or probably knew about Masonic ideas. So I don't think that it's far-fetched to propose that kind of a theory about Eyes Wide Shut, especially when we see the same kind of esoteric metaphysical themes popping up in, say, 2001. So what I argue is that the story with Bill Harford, and this is, of course, based on a German novella, Austrian novella, Traumnovella, by Arthur Schnitzler, and you have this sort of willing fool or dupe who's led down this path into understanding that he's not running things. I think you and I have talked about this in the past, that the real message of the story is that the people out there, you know, that even those that might think that they're at the top of the food chain, the nouveau riche or the upper middle class doctor or somebody like this, they're not really in charge. And it's people more like Soros, right, who are running things. And that's totally what we've seen, especially with WikiLeaks. And I mean, we already kind of knew this. Soros has bragged openly about all the color revolutions and things that he's manufactured and manipulated, right, on a global scale.
Yeah, he's a magus, right?
And Soros wrote his book, Alchemy of Finance. So yeah. I don't think that it's totally out of step with even Soros. But so what is going on in Eyes Wide Shut? I think that he's there's several things going on. So Kubrick's not just playing with surrealism and levels of reality and dream states and things like that. That's all part of it. But he's also telling us that there is a way in which people are brought into the power structure and they're compromised. And that's, I think, especially relevant with what we've seen with the Pizzagate and the Epstein, Little St. James Island, and all this stuff with WikiLeaks and the Clintons and the Podestas and all that. It's very appropriate to what we see in Eyes Wide Shut, because Bill's curiosity, that's the Tom Cruise character, Bill Harford, it leads him down this path where he thinks he's achieving freedom. And the irony, of course, is that the more he goes down this dangerous path of trying to find out who's in this whole sex cult thing, he discovers that his whole reality is manipulated, that everything he's believed was a lie. And I think you and I have discussed in the past, and it comes up in my book, it's very similar to the story of the Magus by John Fowles, where you have the willing dupe who arrogantly thinks he understands everything, and then he doesn't understand this larger level of manipulation and control by these oligarchs, moneyed elite and old money. You get the impression that in the Eyes Wide Shut situation, that because it requires an ermine cloak, and this is the cloak worn by the royalty in Europe, and because of the British accent of the Hierophant or whatever this sort of cult leader guy is here, right, that it's a tie-in to old money. And this is also another theme in Kubrick movies. This is a theme in Barry Lyndon, which the main character trying to get into that class of people, and he's just not welcome because he's not blood, right? So the only other way into that group is new money, but that takes a while, and it's not easy to obtain billions of dollars. And so, in other words, this is what Bill's learning, and that is the message of the film that we in the public don't know and don't learn. Or at least when Kubrick was making this film, I think he would have said, you out there in the audience, your eyes are wide shut to how the world really works. And again, as I pointed out with Henrik, the cult, we talked about this many times, I talk about it in the book, the cults are very similar to intelligence agencies and the trafficking of secret information. And this ties in well to your point about the mafia and blackmail, because this cult in the film has at its disposal all the means of an intelligence agency. They're able to craft the news story about the dead beauty pageant girl. They're able to tail Bill Harford around town. They're able to put Swallows, sex operatives in his life, Domino. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have all these means at their disposal. And so they, for all intents and purposes, might as well be. So maybe intelligence agencies actually operate like a cult. Maybe that's what's really going on. But so I dive into the symbolism, and it has a lot of the sort of classical tropes of mind control, like Over the Rainbow and Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland, with the Nicole Kidman character. And I mentioned, you know, a couple of examples of Dominique Strauss-Kahn and the Dutroux affair, where we've seen glimpses of this kind of stuff going on with the power elite. So I also, you know, I also get into kind of the notion of rituals and gender and rebirth, and how there's this sort of in all paganism, there's always the obsession with the generative principle and the birth cycle and nature, right? Because it always ends up in nature worship. That's really what it is. And what is the most potent force in nature? Well, sex and recreation, right? Mm-hmm. Or generation. So I talk about that, and I talk about, you know, it does kind of seem to have these Crowleyan overtones, and there's whispers that Kubrick wanted to use Crowley's voice during the ritual scenes, but for some reason he couldn't. And so he used Orthodox chant in reverse. Mm-hmm. It's a Romanian Orthodox, which suggests obviously satanic, since it's being reversed. Excuse me. So you get this kind of super elite that are, in a Nietzschean sense, beyond good and evil. I'm not saying they really are, but I'm saying in the film they're presented this way, and they're kind of like shoving it in Bill's face that, oh, you want to keep going down this path? Well, here's what you're really, here's what's at the bottom of this rabbit hole. Do you really want to go here? And, you know, there's other aspects of the film that you could debate whether or not Nicole Kidman's character was a part of it all along.
Yeah,
or which, you know, who knows? But so that's what I mean, it's a kind of gaslighting is not the right word. I just thought it was interesting that, I think, because Jay Wiedner makes the point that 2001 begins with the screen being very closely linked to the monolith, and then it seems to kind of be a ritual initiation. I thought, well, actually, the same kind of thing's going on with Eyes Wide Shut, mm-hmm. because the people watching it are really the character of Bill Harford, most likely.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, the middle, upper middle class, perhaps.
And thinking that they know, right? And this is what characterizes the professional class, we might say. They went to the university. They've invested in the system, so they know how the world works, right? Well, I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. I know how the world works, but in fact, they do not.
Yeah, their ego and their contentedness, yes, blinds them to the reality of things. You know,
yeah, and that's why you have so many references in the film to, you know, there's other aspects that I didn't really go into, like Freudianism, and there's Jungian archetypes, and there's references to sociology quite often. You know, when Bill is in Domino's apartment, you know, she's got a shelf full of Carl Jung and sociology books. It's interesting for a street hooker to have this kind
and,
of
in her appearance, she doesn't look like your typical street hooker.
Exactly, right.
I mean, it's she's a high, if anything, if she's in that line of work, she's a high.
And there's a lot of irony in that. It's like, Bill, come on, like, he should be catching on, you see what I'm saying? And
yeah.
So he's a willing fool, and I think that's illustrative for a lot of the public in terms of, like, come on, you ought to be catching on by now, right? Like, you know, the story of 9/11 doesn't make sense. Come on, right? It's like, mm-hmm. you don't really get how the world really works. So I think that's what Kubrick's probably saying. And I'm not trying to import motives to, because I don't know Kubrick's motives. But, you know, you can interpret that how you will. But I think he does continually have this theme of trying to show you how the world is really operating, what's really going on.
I think you make this point, or at least you allude to it, how the voyeuristic element of it.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
And that itself has a degrading effect on the audience. It introduces this world to you and in a way kind of normalizes it. Because if this stuff happens, if these transgressions are occurring and nothing is done about it, it normalizes it gradually in the eyes
of the
public.
That's a good point.
Yeah,
and it also kind of says that in a way, viewing the film might be hypocritical because, one could argue is pornographic, especially towards the end. Well, the scene at the end, of course, or toward middle end, whatever. The ritual scene.
Yeah. Which right. I understand was supposedly more graphic. It was edited. So.
That was edited, supposedly, right. Yeah. And I've not searched out the full version or whatever. I mean, there's enough in there. But what I think is interesting in that regard is that it's a lot worse than that in the sense of it's probably... In other words, what really goes on is Dutroux affair. It's what we believe might be going on with Podesta. That's probably what's really going on.
Yes.
And so it's a lot worse than people just having sexual liaisons or trysts or whatever.
And the idea of throwing up all these, you know, willing and available beautiful women walking around with nothing on, and to the middle class with some semblance of, you know, of more sexual of inhibition in matters mm-hmm. regarding sex and morality. It's like, you know, they're laughing at middle America.
There you go.
Middle class values and decency. And ultimately, you know, it's that – because anything, when you bring in sexual – when you do away with sexual inhibition or some sort of idea of sexual morality, is a natural reduction occurs. There's – you commodify and you cheapen human life because obviously you're treating other human beings as objects
mm-hmm.
without some sense of morality and when it comes to sex. I was listening to Hoax Busters the other day, and Chris was talking about this, the Comet Pizza pedophile mm-hmm. thing. And he was saying he's no doubt that this is going on. Now, whether this revelation, this evidence is real or not, isn't really significant. The point he was making, he was saying the whole point of all this stuff is to get it out there,
mm-hmm.
get people talking about it. Just to get you talking about it degrades you somewhat because it desensitizes you. And he was going off about the Monica Lewinsky scandal and mm-hmm. how that was sort of a ritual of initiation to degrade the public even more, because what that really sparked was all this open talk about fellatio. And pretty soon you had them talking about, and eighth graders were talking about it because it was in the news. You have the news talking about it.
Yes, that's a good point. There's some kind of balance here. I don't know that I have the answer, but. You know, I mean, for example, the Bible itself is not very prudish. There's quite a bit of graphic and violent and just perversion aspect. there are perverted aspects of the Bible for the purpose of instruction in many cases. You know, they have the hooker, I believe, in Judges being chopped up. You have, you know, the case of... Solomon and his many wives, you got all kinds of stuff like this.
Sodom
and Gomorrah, exactly. Yeah. Now, funny story, some of the Puritans, by the way, would not preach certain parts of the Bible because they thought it was too lurid to mention, which is interesting given that they believed in the inspiration through the Holy Spirit. But in other words, if the texts are inspired, then you'd have to argue that the Holy Spirit was being lurid, which is stupid. But so there's some kind of balance here because the Bible, you know, even gives us stories that are instructive for that purpose. But I think the problem is that when you have a society that's so debased and so bombarded with this toxic sexual psychological warfare, it becomes a situation where they don't have a moral compass from which to even be able to make those kinds of distinctions, if that makes sense. In other words, I was if you take another example, like say cocaine or opiates. Now, in my opinion, my view. Cocaine and opiates and so forth, since 100 years ago or so, used to be sold at a drugstore. In a more healthy functioning society, it makes the most sense to me that those things should be sold in a drugstore. I mean, I think that's rational, perfectly reasonable, makes sense. Now, so people who might be, say, libertarians would argue, now we can't do that anymore, or we got to go back to that. But the problem is that the society at that time was a lot healthier, I would say. I understand there were problems, but this was, you know, prior to the 60s revolution and so forth. And so if the society as a whole doesn't even have a moral compass, it's, I would say, even more dangerous perhaps to try to go back to some older, more liberal, I guess. I don't mean liberal in the political sense, but liberal in an economic sense of, you know, being able to go buy cocaine at a drugstore. Mm-hmm. In other words, we've been so debased that it would probably be even worse now.
Because the degradation, the societal conditions are such that people don't have the inner controls that are necessary for external freedom.
Self-government, right?
Yeah.
And so if the same kind of a point could be made probably about how you approach and discuss very degrading and perverse actions on the part of cults or the elite or whatever. I mean, then again, on the other hand, it also kind of puts it in the face of people to – it almost forces people to realize that there is real evil, because what I see is a lot of people denying. Like they won't even consider the possibility, because if they did consider that possibility, they would have to admit, oh, there's actually something genuinely evil in the world, and that presupposes that there's good and probably God, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And so it's part of the left's, you know, psychology to justify and to deny evil. Right? Mm-hmm. Evil, quote unquote, can only be some sort of psychological aberration or chemical imbalance or something. It can't be any kind of real spiritual force, because that then brings us back to metaphysics and God.
Yeah, it's like the priest and the exorcist, Father Damien, who at first thinks he's a psychiatrist, and he thinks, mm-hmm. you know, this is,
yes, there you go,
this is crazy, it's obviously a psychological disorder, and all of a sudden she goes through all these tests, and all the doctors look at her, and they find their conclusion is you might want to think of an exorcism.
Well, that's funny you say that, because that's sort of the point I try to make in the next chapter of The Shining, where I mm-hmm. argue that, you know, whatever you think of Stephen King or Kubrick, the story seems to be about demonic possession. It's not really about ghosts. I mean, in a loose sense, it's ghosts. But the real monster in the story, the real minotaur of the labyrinth, is Jack, the dad. Mm-hmm. Now, you could argue, Kubrick does have this tendency towards kind of class warfare and Marxist elements in his movies, especially something like Spartacus. And he does take a generally kind of a critical attitude towards America, which, you know, in the 60s and 70s and so forth, that would have been seen as very radical, and how dare you critique America. But a lot of the points that he's criticizing about America are accurate, I would say, with this elite class of degenerates. I don't think that he's accurate when he kind of throws in these critiques of patriarchy or white males. I don't believe he's right about that, but I do believe he's right about the overall sort of criticism of what America is. And that it's actually decadent, and that the middle class that we talked about earlier, they don't and can't seem to understand that. like this is just my own sort of assessment, is that, and it might have even been one of the Rolling Stones that said something like this, I can't remember, but somebody's made the point or the idea tossed out there that there is potentially more of an affinity betwixt vagabonds and bohemians and the superclass oligarchic elite, precisely because those two classes of persons tend to have seen through the lies in society. Mm-hmm. The oligarchic elite understand that they manipulate and control, and many of the con artists, the lower class, vagabond, bohemian types understand that it's kind of a rigged system, right? So,
but it's the middle class that foolishly believes in the fairy tales of democracy and rule of law.
And they become the engine of the system that props it up. And that, I think, is probably why the elite tend to have such a disdain and hatred for the middle class. And, you know, they'll like somebody who's, you know, some sort of bohemian or something.
Yeah, and the irony is that in order to get approximate a society that actually does respect something approaching the rule of law, justice, decency, and fairness, you have to first acknowledge that we're nowhere near it right now. That's not the status quo.
Right, but as Chris often says, and I think he's right, America is viewed kind of like a cult. People really worship. That's, you know, there's a lot of power in patriotism, which I don't think is inherently bad. But America, it has become a kind of giant cult thing that that people worship the idea of.
And we see that in sporting events with the militarism.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
The idea is that to be patriotic is to, you know, support blowing up brown people and
don't ever really look into the idea of why we're doing this or what the reasoning is here. It's just kind of just sort of blindly follow along.
Or the fact that it's also the source of so many domestic problems, whether it's either family breakup, dissolution, or just, you know,
or all the troops coming back and committing suicide and having mental problems. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and even troubles like immigration issues regarding, well, Europe's getting it. They're being targeted for various reasons, but also the destabilization, the decades of destabilization that's occurred in Latin America. Mm-hmm. You know, Operation Fast and Furious, right? That's obviously the destabilization program. In your face. And,
oh, yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and what they did with, you know, with NAFTA and what how it upset agricultural areas south of the border, that brings it the great migration northwards. And that's, you go, it's the same thing with, well, that's almost like a model. It's getting kind of off what we're talking about. The idea of you destabilize an area, then you exploit the displaced population, you use it for cheap labor. That's the British model. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the industries of the North utilized that because it was a lot of the victims of British genocide in Ireland, which came over to the United States, which populated the North, which filled the ranks of the Union Army and also the factories of the North to crush the South.
Well, interestingly, you know, in the Shining chapter, I talk about how Kubrick is kind of critiquing the American Indian aspect of that. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this is kind of an endless trope of the left, is to say, oh, you know, all the white people are evil because they ripped off the Indians or whatever. But actually, that's not that simple. It's not either way, like a simple either way. Because number one, the Indians were actually pretty savage. Many of those tribes would kill and scalp one another.
I think there's a book called like the Wars Before Time or something about ancient Indian wars. Yeah. About that, yeah.
Yeah, and similar to the way that the African tribes would enslave one another and then sell them to not just whites, but also Arabs and the Jewish slave traders and Chinese slave traders.
Yes.
So, you know, history is more complex than trying to go through it and pick out good guys and bad guys in big senses, right?
Yeah, I was reading about the abolition of the slave trade, of the Western slave trade, and particularly efforts made by the British Navy to suppress the slave trade coming into the Americas. And while it was rather effective in doing that, and people see that as a great achievement for humanity and decency and justice, it shifted a huge part of the slave trade eastward, which is much more brutal. However bad slavery was in the West, it was much less brutal than it was in the East, but the East African trade.
Yeah.
And it actually resulted in many more deaths and suffering.
Well, I think you and I talked about that there were probably ulterior motives behind, you know, Wilberforce might have been a, you know, willing dupe, but there were probably ulterior motives behind that whole movement.
Yeah, well, I think Catherine Smith made the point is the financing of slavery seemed to shift. And now the people in Britain could afford to indulge their principles, whereas prior to that they couldn't, or at least they wouldn't. And so that gave it the big push in Britain to ban slavery. It's always you always have to look at the ulterior motives or, you know, the deeper interest behind these things. This isn't to question the motives of some of the activists. It's just
right.
The reason why they're getting momentum to begin with is because the money power now backs them, you know. So
right.
So with Kubrick's work, particularly Eyes Wide Shut, is it does reveal the idea that there is this elite that doesn't play by the same rules, that laughs at the what we call middle class decency and middle class values. At the same time, it's working to degrade the values of
of the population of the of the public in general through introducing these things. Of course, Hollywood's a great vehicle for that, for that process, because the cinema, it attracts so many people, and so many people. When we're talking about movies, we're talking about television, entertainment in general.
Right.
And so that's done in music, it's done in advertisement, Madison Avenue, Hollywood, in ways that, literature can't.
Yeah, the entire mass media is really, and I mean, and that includes the music industry too, obviously, is a giant vehicle for, moving the herd in the direction that you want it to go. And, with the importation of these Frankfurt School types and the adoption of that philosophy and approach by particularly, the Rockefellers, who are committed to depopulation, committed to, all these Planned Parenthood and all that, it's not hard to figure out what's going on here. This is all by design, in the sense of it has nothing to do with the way that, like you said, middle-class Americans would view the world. This is the view of the world from the oligarchic perspective, because it's the oligarchic perspective is purely pragmatic and purely based on outcomes. And the outcome is obviously depopulation and, reorganization of the globe. And I think that the reason they like things like Marxism is because Marxism and socialism, they centralize and they are inherently technocratic, as is monopoly capitalism. And, you and I have talked about that before. Then the oligarchic elite want to go towards, that technocratic model, so that they can control things. David Rockefeller said this on more than one occasion, that, nationalism is done, all these older movements are done, because we've evolved into this new phase of technology where we have the ability now to erect a society that's managed. And he says that something to the effect of, if we don't run it, it'll be chaos.
Yeah, and of course there's chaos in a monolithic system too, because there's no checks and balances.
Right. Well,
they rule the roost. Their idea of chaos is just resistance.
Exactly.
Having to accommodate other people's interests, having to negotiate, and competition is a sin, right? As David Rockefeller's father reportedly said. And that's why their business model is monoculture, which is why you see their agents, whether it's Soros working to the NGOs to introduce the worst aspects of the base Western culture into places like whether the Ukraine or Syria or Iraq,
Georgia or wherever.
Georgia, and what's being promoted is abortion, gay rights, and which leads to what, depopulation. And and of course, what you get in an area like Russia is you get a vast country whose resources and system isn't entirely within the Anglo-American Empire fold. And so that has to be brought into the game. And that's why there's so much animus towards Russia and maybe even China. I think China's more integrated than what it appears, because they've been under, I think, effective CFR occupation since the 20s, or arguably since the days of the British East India Company.
Yeah.
It's like a phase they went through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what I what I kind of tried to lay out in the 2001 chapter was Kubrick, I think, laying out the mandate of the elite's view of itself through their belief in their own claim to own all space. And so because they believe that they're at the top of the social Darwinian chain, they believe that it's their, they have the right to the future. And, Charles Galton Darwin spoke this way. He wrote a book called The Next 1,000 Years, or The Next Million Years, excuse me. And he speaks this way about how it won't even matter down the road, because we will, basically evolve to be the wild men, and we'll run things, and the rest of whoever's left around will be our, troglodyte slaves or whatever. So I tried to point out how, and I disagree with Kubrick. I think Kubrick was a committed Darwin fanatic, and he seems to say this, you know, at times in interviews. And the film was co-written with Arthur C. Clarke, who was also one of these Illuminists that ran in the circles of Crowley and you know, Childhood Zen. You know, it's kind of a more or less a what's the right word? I'm like, well, you and I have talked before about how.
But that ends in genocide, doesn't it?
It does, right? And so does 2001 with Starchild nuking the Earth and stuff. And but that's the I think the point is that they're trying to say that they're the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've talked about this before, well, right? We're the
H.G. Wells, right?
Yeah,
I think your chart, your second part or third or H.G. Wells and the War of the Worlds and Island of Dr. Moreau and and of course the War of the Worlds is you could say is a sort of like a view of how these people view the rest of the world, how the Martians viewed the Earthlings.
Yeah, and I think some of them do believe in panspermia and aliens and that you know demons and that if they when they do LSD or ayahuasca that they're actually seeing and communicating with quote aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But then you know somebody like David Rockefeller, I think he probably thinks oh that's a code allegory by the way I'm the great alien. Leader,
yeah.
You know.
Well, remember that story about the nine?
Exactly, yeah, and sensor forces, right?
Yeah, now is that like a bunch of rich folks being duped, like at a seance?
I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
could be.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
With Andrea Puharik.
The Park Affair, yeah, the nine. Because
yeah.
I think Peter Lavender writes about that.
And right.
It's like, you know, it sounds like, you know, it's almost like a, you know, one of these seances where some person would con a bunch of rich people into. You know, hey, look, you're talking to spirits. You're talking to space people.
Yeah.
You know,
let's invest in my foundation for the the new alien space brothers.
Well, which this section gets into the whole idea, the whole meme of the alien meme and H.G. Wells and the scientism behind that, and ultimately the Luciferianism behind it, right? I mean,
yeah, and some people might think that. Why would you put that chapter in there? Well, because H.G. Wells is one of these forefathers of science fiction, and science fiction, after probably Spielberg, you could argue, becomes the dominant money-making thing in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Slash fantasy, right? Harry Potter and all that.
Yeah.
So prior to that, you know, the dominant, you would have the names, right? Humphrey Bogart, right, would draw people, or... you know, Ingrid Bergman would draw people. And then there, you had kind of this shift to where people were really amazed with 2001, A Space Odyssey, but I don't know that it made that much money. And then by the time of Disney, you know, investing in a lot of a special effects stuff and them trying to do 2001 with the black hole. And then you eventually get by the time of, I think you could probably argue Close Encounters is like really the first sci-fi movie that kind of wowed people on a big scale. That's 1977, same year as Star Wars, right? So Star Wars and Close Encounters.
Yeah, the acting and the production quality is so high in those two films.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it draws you into it. Just the whole visuals of the whole thing. Yeah, the visuals of these films draw you in.
And with Close Encounters, you've got a direct connection to what I think is probably a psyop with the character Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was a consultant on the film. And this is this whole mythology of the MJ-12 documents, all this, the idea that, oh, the government is covering up the aliens, when in actual fact, aliens serve the deep state very well. For one, you know, as I cite in the book, the Collins brothers wrote an article a long time ago about how aliens is a smokescreen because there's probably a lot of drug running and black market stuff that actually goes on at Area 51 or places like this. It also kind of covers up for technology because you've got people running around in circles thinking that there's ET when, you know, that's not what these big corporations are up to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're up to a lot of shady black market stuff, I think. And so what I tried to do with the Spielberg section was point out these kind of deep state background connections in the Spielberg films and also the kind of occultic Kabbalistic stuff as well, which I do think is there. For example, you know, in Close Encounters, you have this strange connection between language and sounds and vibration being the means by which the aliens speak to us. And you know, this is harkens directly to Kabbalism, and so I presume that, you know, Spielberg is probably borrowing or hinting at Kabbalistic ideas here. And then you have, you know, these weird things like where the government fakes the news in Close Encounters. They to cover up for the alien thing, they fake a bio release, like a giant chemical release, and this is all fake news that's all put on the news, and everybody goes into a panic, right? We think of the panic of Orson Welles with the aliens, right?
Yeah,
that's the radio broadcast, which was a Rockefeller psyop, which I touch on in the book.
Yeah, and how did he control? Wrote a book called Invaders from Mars or something, admitting it that this is all a big test.
Right.
And the timing of that's very important because this is 1938. This is the run-up to the war, and getting the public into a panic is very important to support the war effort.
Right.
And this also coincides with the war and peace studies at the CFR that the Rockefellers were funding. They were already planning the post-war in 1938 for their management of the world after the, you know, after the war. So.
Right. And then in the next section, I kind of delve into more goofy and satirical and silly stuff. But actually, in some of these silly films, you'll find some very weird things. Like Logan's Run has some – it's basically a euthanasia-based society where you have a certain date that you live to, age 30 or something, and then you're basically supposed to float off and be incinerated. And, you know, this is sold to you as, it's great, you know, you go off to Valhalla or something.
Yeah.
But it's actually a completely controlled, you know, technocratic state. And this is based on a novel, which I haven't read the novel, but I thought it was a fun thing to do. And then there's, of course, Zardoz with Sean Connery, which I do think it's worth watching. Because even though it's kind of a B-movie, the message of Zardoz is it's Freemasonic, and you have this elite that kind of grows into this sort of apathetic stage of they're tired of being the gods, and then you have this Promethean revolt on the part of Zed, played by Sean Connery, and then the message of the whole thing is that society is run by like an AI smart grid, quote, tabernacle, they call it. But it's all a presentation of sort of Nietzschean eternal return and Freemasonry. And I think that it is, you know, kind of that Illuminous philosophy being repeated. And that's what we see repeated so often in these stories. Never ending story, famous children's thing. The author is a Crowleyan. He explicitly said he liked Crowley. So, you know, even in these children's fantasy stories, and I'm not trying to be prudish. I like Tolkien a lot. I'm not saying that all fantasy is somehow evil or something like that, but you do get these very strange, bizarre themes, you know, in Hollywood's presentation of even these children's stories.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, the guy who, of course, made these movies regarding the Tolkien stories, Peter Jackson, turns out being a big backer of the guy Damien Echols.
Memphis 3, yeah.
Yeah, so there's, you know, what's his motivation for that, you know? So...
And then, you know, I go into some of the Ridley Scott movies that were popular in the 80s and Blade Runner. And so, you know, Philip K. Dick stories have a lot of predictive programming.
However, definitely, yeah.
So, that, you know, that he pops up in the sense of there being three or four of his movies in the book. And then, you know, I think Blade Runner is very important as a film, not just because of its, you know, technical and artistic achievements, but also because the story has, well, it's not just like an occultic esoteric thing, but also it's all about simulacrum. It's all about synthetic reality basically invading our reality. And then, you know, are we going to stamp these things out, or are they going to be the future? And, all, you know, this is like the point of AI, Spielberg's AI. But I just find it fascinating that nanotechnology and sex bots is like a big part of Blade Runner, and that's what we see nowadays. And this was, you know, the movie was made in 1982. I don't remember when Philip K. Dick wrote his novella, but I mean, it's just phenomenal predictive programming, I guess we could say.
Yeah, you get that with virtual reality.
Oh yeah, right.
The simulacrum, and of course, immediately you think pornography. And what it already has done with the, you know, between relations between the sexes the yeah. how it stunts the psychological development of so many people, particularly males. But this idea, I read a thing online that apparently this thing called the Fleshlight. And I don't know if this is real or not, but it says it's basically it's a type of technology where you can mimic sensation through the internet.
Well, but have you seen the articles about the sex bots?
Yeah. It's just, right now it's in Asia, right?
Which is and there was some place in the UK that I think had has them in a coffee house shop or something ridiculous like that.
You know, but I mean, why? I mean, if you develop a if virtual reality develops to the point where you can put on some goggles and you can't tell the difference between a real woman and an imaginary woman, and you can recreate, I don't know, let's say recreate Raquel Welch. Okay, in her prime, and then you have the technology to mimic physical sensation, the interaction with that virtual reality. There'll be absolutely no incentive for people to develop real relations, particularly males.
I guess that's the point of it.
I guess female sex bots will have men who listen to them. I don't know.
That's funny.
You know, but I'm thinking about how it stunts. I'm looking up for my own. I grew up in a relatively innocent time. Before the internet, okay, but I look back at my youth at the movies I saw, how it would scar you because you're being hit with things. You know, at the time, cable TV was coming up, becoming popular, so you'd see things in when you're 13, 14, 15, and this does harm you. You know, I don't think you know we should be able to look at ourselves and say how were we harmed in our youth by popular culture, and you know, you know, I'm not saying I'm damaged goods, but in a sense we are damaged goods. In fact, that's even a wasn't that a play that Bernays popularized, you know, damaged goods. You know,
good
and
point.
So, you know, and this is what it does. Now think about it today, what kids or what teenagers or preteens, 12, 13 year olds are confronted with today, and this multiply that 1,000 with virtual reality. And why would you ever even learn? I mean, part of development is learning to understand and cope and deal with the opposite sex.
The opposite sex, right.
You know, because they're different, you know. So you learn, you know, some people never learn, of course. But, you know, we're all kind of left questioning. You know, that's part of, you know, and what comes from that is humor and you know, how we deal with one another. With this, there's no, I mean, it's almost like that. What was that movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yes, with Jim Carrey,
Where they never, because people's bad memories are erased, they never develop.
Exactly, that's a good point. And I mean, it reminds me of Blade Runner again, because when Catherine Austin Fitz and I had an interview, she made a great point that if you'll notice, the point of a lot of these movies that deal with bots and AI and all this stuff, is to humanize the bots. They're always humanized. And then humans are always made to be robotic, right?
Yeah.
So they want humans to be robotic, and then we're supposed to view the bots as like the real humans. That's how David is viewed in AI, Spielberg's AI. He's good, while the actual human boy who's crippled is this total butthole.
But he's pure. He's
exactly.
Programmed to be pure.
Right.
Yeah.
Westworld is now this new series that Christopher Nolan's brother is doing with J.J. Abrams on HBO that everybody's watching. In Westworld, it's the exact same scenario where you have this giant virtual playground, sort of like a Disneyland, where you go and all of the animatronic beings there are AI bots, and you can kind of do whatever you want. You can shoot them, you can rape them, and do whatever. And the humans are all evil. And the bots are good. And so this is definitely the trend. And I think it ties into the point that Dugin has made, that this is sort of the logical step of liberalism, is that liberalism says we've got to transcend all limitations and all rules and all law, because that's perceived to be what freedom is, when it's not. It's actually slavery.
Yeah.
Because you can't have freedom without law. And so the idea of transcending all the limitations has to include after gender, right? So we've had the transcending of race. We've had supposedly the transcending of gender now with feminism and transgender stuff. The next step has to be the transcending of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so post-humanism and so forth, they're the logical next step. You have to say that. So what we're being primed with is the kind of stuff that science fiction was priming people back you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we're now being primed with what we're going to see in 20 or 30 years with the implementation. I do think we're going to see the implementation of AI. I don't think it'll be obviously consciousness, or they're not going to be conscious or anything like that. But the whole point of it's going to be a psyop, as you said, to reduce population. The only reason they would care about it.
Yeah, at the ultimate population. In the meantime, you cannot have the benefit of an intimate relationship without privacy. Otherwise, there's nothing to intimacy without privacy.
That's a great point, yeah.
And so the public display, this is why I was always taken aback by things like the concept of the stripper. It never interested me because there's nothing special to it. There's no reveal to it. It's, you know, and this is with sex too, is without some sense of limitation, sex loses interest, which means you have to go deeper into more perversion.
That's funny because that's in Zardoz, which ultimately the message of the film is Masonic, so I can't recommend that aspect of it. But yeah, they do, there is an insight into that where the elites in Zardoz have complete and total apathy because they've experienced every pleasure in any sense that they want. And so they just don't care about anything anymore.
Yeah.
And they're lazy. They're lazy and they lay around. And Zed, the Sean Connery character, who's this sort of wild man, barbarian guy, he's like, he can't believe the society of the elites, how they are, because he's like, you don't even care about anything. They're all just like, whatever.
Yeah.
We've had it all.
So, you know, and what happens when you have it all? There's nothing more to get. What do you turn into? You know.
Well, yeah, he leads a rebellion against them, and they all just die because they don't even fight back. They're just like, yeah. they're like totally nihilistic. They don't even care. They're just like, whatever.
You know, it's one of these things. You know, it's you don't acknowledge these limitations. These limitations are good because
this is a great point. I learned a long time ago, even as a Protestant, and I have to give credit to I don't recommend all of his works, but it was a great insight that Rush Jenny had, who's sort of the father of homeschooling movement. And I don't think that, yes, he was a dominionist, but I think that you could exaggerate the power and influence of dominionism. I don't really think it had that big of a, I don't think that evangelical dominionists are running America.
I think they're more of they're tools.
However, Rush Jenny, I don't think fits the mold. He's a very insightful guy, as weird as he is. But I read a lot of his books when I was in my 20s. But he made a great point in Institutes of Biblical Law that we hear a lot about freedom, and people talk about freedom. And he's like, but you can't, it's absolutely impossible to have freedom without boundaries and laws. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have boundaries and laws, then your human person can be violated by somebody else. Right, so you've got to have boundaries and laws, and in the actual fact, God created the world to have laws and boundaries. Right, we're for example, gender is a boundary, and I don't believe it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. There's nothing. I mean, we have private. We have walls around the house. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a boundary. There's walls around, you know, a swimming pool. Right, mm-hmm. It's a fence around a swimming pool. That's a boundary. So those things are good things, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. And in the same sense, you can't eliminate laws, you can't eliminate boundaries and distinctions. It's absolutely impossible. And it just shows that the drive to get rid of law, to be totally free in that sense, is not only is it impossible, but it's actually an attack on nature, I think is the key point. Mm-hmm.
I think, here's a quote from Edmund Burke. He says, "Society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere. And the less of it there is within, the more there must be without. It is ordained in the internal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters."
Well, think about Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus actually, a lot of people are under the mistaken notion that Jesus was some sort of revolutionary who came to like abolish everything in the Old Testament. Actually, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, not one jot or tittle will fail from all of the law until heaven and earth pass away. Mm-hmm. So he came and fulfilled the ceremonial commands of the law, which are then I believe transferred into the ritual and worship of the church. And then you have the moral law, which was always applicable even before the giving of the law at Sinai. Mm-hmm. Right? It was still wrong to be an idolater prior to Mount Sinai. And you have those injunctions often in Genesis and even early Exodus. So those principles, those maxims, that are inherent to nature and creation never pass away. And so the idea that you could have completely anarchic, and that's ultimately where that has to lead, that sort of hyper-libertarian perspective leads to that conclusion that the family is a tyranny, because the family is a constriction. It's a kind of kingship with mm-hmm. the father and the queen, mother is the queen, and the children. These become, if you're consistent, these are tyrannies, right? The tyranny yeah. of the family, the tyranny of nature, right?
But that whole appeal is part of the dialectic, I think, to atomize society.
Yes,
do
absolutely.
Do away with those little platoons of society that actually make freedom possible.
Absolutely. Really, yeah,
in the final analysis, yeah.
How can you have freedom without a tradition? So this is another notion that revolutionaries of whatever stripe, right or left, don't remember that a tradition is a foundation of freedom. You know, Deuteronomy says, do not remove the boundaries of the forefathers, right? And that's a reason for that, and that is that you're not smarter than all of your ancestors. And it's foolish to think you are, but every hardcore revolutionary has to also war on the past, not just the present, because the past is part of what gives us our interpretation of the present, right? Mm-hmm. Our understanding of our history, where we came from, heritage, lineage, who a father is, who a mother is, what our society is, and so forth, right? All these things have to be warred on by the revolutionary.
Which is why Google
if he's consistent.
Which is why Google is working so hard to digitize all information.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's a great point.
Revising reality. Wow.
Well, how many of these sci-fi dystopian stories, I think in Logan's Run, when he leaves his technocratic control grid, he stumbles upon this like old library.
Yeah.
This is in time. I think it's also in War of the Worlds. Not War of the Worlds. Time Machine. He stumbles upon the library and he's like, "What are these?"
Yeah.
They're like, I think maybe they were books or something. What is that?
And they run into an old man.
At the end of Logan's Run.
What is that? I think it looks like when you get old.
Whoa! Yeah.
Man, you're old, you know. So, well, the next part, most interesting. Well, one of the more interesting parts in the book is the part on, 007 and Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. You covered Diamonds Are Forever and one of my favorite movies, North by Northwest, and the significance of the whole, of Hitchcock, of the Bond genre or mm-hmm. not genre, but you know, films or novels, I guess, and the whole spy culture.
That
I guess particularly after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think we've talked about it, but you know, Bond prior to Harry Potter was the world's biggest money-making franchise, and then you had Harry Potter come, and I think as franchises go, it took over as the top one. You know, of course, that would be up there with like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and all that. But you know, Bond has been going for a long time. So, and presumably will continue going. But I don't want to necessarily talk about Bond so many times. But what's interesting is that I think that best ties into our conversation today. The reboot Quantum of Solace, and we will talk about Diamonds Are Forever. But Quantum of Solace comes to mind because if you remember the plot, and this is kind of people kind of poo-pooed this one out of the new ones, but actually of all the new Daniel Craig reboots, it's the most revelatory because you have this character who works for Quantum, which is the kind of replacement. We learn ultimately that it is Spectre, this shadowy cartel, international terrorist mafia organization. Quantum is intimately tied into the Green Agenda. Mr. Green is who runs it, and he has basically set it up to where they are going to game the system in terms of controlling natural resources in some, like, a Latin American country, I think, if I recall. And they're going to privatize it all through government control. So they buy off this government guy that they put in, who's their puppet. He's going to sign it all over to this private company who's going to provide water. And the actual water, natural resource, has been, it's like controlled. Like they bought up the land and they're going to, they've created a manufactured crisis for water, right? Now, this is the model of how the monopoly corporations, the global elite, the Soros, this is how they game systems.
That's Agenda 21. That's Club of Rome.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the perfect model of, now in this case, it's water, but you could use that for oil, controlling the oil flow, the oil market, OPEC, and Bilderberg being behind OPEC. You could look at, like we talked about with Iran, right? Anglo-Iranian oil company, right? The Seven mm-hmm. Sisters and trying to have monopoly over the oil. And same with diamonds and the De Beers and the Rothschilds with the diamond market. You control the market and then you can set the price, right? And competition is a sin, so you don't have competition. And I just think it's amazing that the
wasn't there a huge aquifer in Libya, too, that they wanted to get control of?
Oh, that's a good point. But it actually is a big aquifer in the quantum story.
Yeah.
But there's a great quote by Mr. Green, and he says to Bond, "You should know something about the people that I work with. We deal with the left or the right, with dictators or liberators." I thought that was a great quote.
I was thinking of that exact quote right now. Yeah, that's okay. A great quote. it's how the world is run like a cartel. Mm-hmm. At least how they go about doing it, how they establish that cartel in the first place. It's always in the name of democracy or conservation or humanity or charity. And that's with the NGOs. That's through creation of false scarcity, crisis, environmental doom, alien invasion, maybe.
Oh, yeah, good point. And then you have this character of Javier Bardem playing this sort of Snowden / Julian Assange kind of character who's, mm-hmm. He's always a cyber threat to the hacking of the security establishment or whatever. And then, what do we find out? Out with WikiLeaks as this big cyber threats now. And if you remember, Sony was supposedly hacked before Spectre was released. Give me a break.
Yeah. now, with North by Northwest, you say the significance of that film is this the first time that the CIA is mentioned?
Well, I think that I read Tom Secker say that, and supposedly the OSS, I believe, was mentioned in a film prior, but I think it is one of the first films of the CIA being mentioned.
Okay, and there's one thing is the concept of the honeypot or sex trap that's used, or sexual entrapment.
Yeah, I should. I think Notorious is prior to North by Northwest, which
that's male to female, right?
Exactly. I was going to say this is sort of the other side, right?
Yeah. That's because you have this character Thornhill, mm-hmm. who's in advertising, which is funny. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And he gets caught into the middle of this thing. One of my favorite scenes is when he's at the mansion with James Mason.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know what the heck's going on. The whole dialogue there is fantastic. But he runs into Eve, this beautiful blonde on the train, I think, right, if mm-hmm. I recall. And of course they establish a bond, a relationship, obviously. There's a scene in the woods when he's meeting with the spy master, the professor, who's almost like an Alan Dulles type character, absent the pipe.
Yes. And it's interesting too that they're academics, right?
Yes.
It's the professor.
Yeah. The professor, yes. And I ran into this analysis. I was reading Derek Liebart's book, The 50-Year Wound, How America's Cold War Victory Shapes Our World. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned North by Northwest, and he goes here, popular art had caught on to the curious backgrounds, peculiar methods, and frequent ineptness of America's secret operatives. In Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, for example, suave madman Cary Grant is mistaken for an agent working for the professor and his Washington colleagues. Mm-hmm. "I don't like the games you play, Professor," exclaims this innocent caught up in the double-edged tactics of something very much like the CIA. "War is hell, even when it's a cold one," responds the spymaster.
unconvinced and appalled that Washington needs to ask girls like the patriotic Eve Marie Saint to bed down with the enemy, Grant tells the professor, perhaps you ought to start learning how to lose a few Cold Wars. The professor replies, I'm afraid we're already doing that, Mr. Thornton. Yeah, right. But that I always thought, you know, how America, you go on these crusades and you lose your soul.
That's a good point. Like, and there's I think you could have done it. I thought about doing The Man Who Knew Too Much, and you almost get the impression, like, is that child trafficking, maybe? Because if you remember, they kidnap Jimmy Stewart's son.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then there's supposed to be an assassination plot, I would think, of a German chancellor at the end of the film, you know, in the famous opera scene or the famous theater scene at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But now that could be child trafficking, though I'm not positive. But I think that throughout, you know, the Hitchcock films, you could do a whole book on just Hitchcock films, just like you could Ian Fleming and Bond. But there's a lot of parallels too between those, and they're kind of a symbiotic influence between those, by the way, which I mentioned, I think, from one of the Bond scholars I read. But I grew up watching Hitchcock films because my dad and mom were both fans, and I never noticed any of this stuff. That's all there, like it's all hinted at, it's all kind of in the film if you paid attention to it and knew about it, right? But you've got, you know, the academic people are really who's kind of in the background, and that's what, you know, Servando says, that the beginning of American intelligence is from academics. It's a bunch of academics recruited into the inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the establishment, you know, the people in the background of the CFR trilateral type saying, oh, we got to have something more, or you need to, you know, let's get the British guys over here to help set up this OSS, and then it becomes the CIA.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, Chris, even in that book, that short story, the Magus, where he artists and academics are used to...
You know, and actors, yes.
And actors, so yeah.
That's who works for Maurice,
Yeah.
Maurice has at his disposal, this whole troupe, who can put on any sort of performance play that he wants at any time.
Give us a glimpse into how things operate, because, well, Alfred Hitchcock, connected to British intelligence, right? Propaganda films, Hollywood. Now, in your concluding chapter, you have the conclusion is the CIA in Hollywood, a dark marriage. And you kind of write about this unholy alliance, but between Hollywood, the CIA, you know, Defense Department, government.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is much more than that, because it's perception management. Mm-hmm. And with that, if you hire academics, hire actors, artists, you can create a simulacrum to pretty much create a perception which renders society more easy to manipulate and control, which is, I think, kind of the general point of the entire book you wrote, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Chris over at Hoaxbusters made this great point that, you know, what does it really do in practice? What Hollywood does is it fills in the gaps for people. Like, so if people are going to understand what happened on 9/11, you know, they saw, you know, these images of the towers and all those TV screens, but the telling of the story they got from, United 93 or World Trade Center or from
Zero Dark 30.
From Zero Dark 30 was what I was about to say. Oh, that's how we got the bad guy, right? And that's 100% a movie made by the CIA or in tandem with the CIA, right? Mm-hmm. So American Sniper 2, anything like that, absolutely. Argo, right?
Mm-hmm. And Argo tells us about what happened with Iran.
Exactly.
But really, if you watch, people watch Iran, they think Arabs, even though they're Persians, and it justifies, you know, occupying and getting involved in foreign countries, in Afghanistan, and, you know, and controlling the heroin trafficking and, you know, whatever minerals they have there. Again, it was one of these things where the whole thing of national security is a scam. It's a racket. War is a racket. You can just say national security is a racket.
Because
under the cover of national security, they can create a cryptocracy, so they avoid any accountability.
Well, yeah, all these criminal activities that are criminal for everybody else suddenly become, you know, necessitated and above the law because, oh, it's a covert operation.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. So that's that simple.
So, but anyway, like I said, it's a it really is a wonderful book. And I'm glad you actually wrote it and put it into a kind of a concise form that's obtainable or easy to read. And obviously, when you're reading separate different articles online, it's not the same thing. You have a coherent message here, which you can get in a book, and you won't get reading disparate articles over the course of several years. I imagine putting it together is rather difficult because although the articles were written, you had to go back and find the sources and also write it in a way that makes it blend together.
Yeah, and you have to do this while you're doing a whole bunch of other things. So it took it was a several month period, 8, 9, 10 months of actually sitting down and putting it all together and all that, and then working with the publisher back and forth. And yeah, it was definitely an arduous task, but I'm glad to finally have my first book out. So that's very cool. And I think people will like everybody that's gotten it. It's only been shipping for a week and a half, 2 weeks officially. And everybody that's gotten it, is really enjoying it. I haven't heard anything bad yet. But, hopefully it will wake people up to, a new level of understanding. The main weapon, I think, as you began the talk, quoting Henrik, the main virus has been through mass media.
Yeah.
If I can help deconstruct that, then I think I've done a good thing.
Yeah. And again, the way it's put together, you have the articles, you make the points about scientism and, mm-hmm. The CIA and MKUltra. Then you have these sidebars with the various characters. So people get a real idea. People get to look at a face, some of these ideas, mm-hmm. whether it's Ewan Cameron or Jolly West, mm-hmm. Frankfurt School guys, or it's, Aldous Huxley. And so within the text, you explain it, but then all of a sudden you have a brief explanation of who Aldous Huxley was.
Right.
And so it's from an instructional standpoint, it's very useful.
Cool.
Thank you, Tim. It's also the type of book that I can go back and read it again. You read an article mm-hmm. and you see myself picking up again. And I remember there being a great point in this book and go back and then reading the article again. So.
Yeah, I don't remember all the stuff that I put in. like I go back and I look at that Eyes Wide Shut chapter, and I'm like, oh, I forgot I talked about that.
Well, yeah. I imagine you could probably use it as a reference book too.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, so
for your stuff, you could get all these ideas together and put it in one book. It's mm-hmm. accessible. So thanks for sending me the copy. I am going to order a physical copy because it's nothing like having a physical copy.
Right. So if people do want to get it, I have signed copies mm-hmm. that I will send out. The best way to get it now is not necessarily through Amazon, but actually if you just get it directly from me, I'll mail it to you and I'll sign it. So if you go to Jay's Analysis, you'll see the about section there and my email's there, and you can just email me and we can do a check or PayPal if you're in the U.S. Now, if you're outside the U.S., it's a little bit more difficult, and it might be the best route for you to get it through Amazon.
Amazon, So, and it does help you. I know Amazon drives a hard bargain, and they, mm-hmm. while they do offer lower prices, this is part of that neoliberal model, I think.
Well, actually, if you get it from me, I can work with people that want it, so I can come fairly close to it.
Oh, okay. But okay. Well, okay. I won't speak.
I need to offer copies anywhere from 20 to 30. So
yeah. But I'm saying you support your work, and
exactly.
The information isn't free. Research isn't free. It's time. Time is probably, we said, the only non-renewable resource. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, this was probably in terms of straight up work. It was probably 2 years of work to do count, if you count the actual writing of the articles and then putting it all together. It was about 2 years. So,
great.
All right.
Well, listen, Jay, I want to thank you for coming back on the show again to talk about it. It's been a great talk, I think.
Thank you, and thank you for helping me.
Yeah, and I'll look forward to getting that book. I'll go to your website.
Okay.
And I'll make it.
Yeah, shoot me an email.
Great. And anything else you want to mention? Any new projects you come to work on?
I think next we'll probably move on to either Program to Kill or Psychological Warfare in the New World Order or Brzezinski, what I'm going to look at next.
Okay, look forward to that. Thanks a lot, Jay. Enjoy the rest of your holiday and enjoy the holiday season. Merry Christmas.
You as well. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
tread on grass at Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile, that's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom because she wanted to be alone. Well, you can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you have even heard of. People who work, suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded, some who suffered in vain. Rudolph Valentino looks very much alive, and he looks up ladies' dresses as they sadly pass him by. Avoid stepping on Bella Lugosi because he's liable to turn and bite. But stand close by Betty Davis because hers was such a lonely life. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you have even heard of. People who work, suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded, some who suffered in. Everybody's in showbiz, it doesn't matter who you are. But those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand with failure along the Hollywood Boulevard. Well, you can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood. Celluloid heroes never feel any pain.